Welcome to The Sanctions Age, the podcast that explores how sanctions are changing the world. My name is Espandyr Batmagelidze. Today's show is about how states exercise power in an interconnected world. In 2019, my guest published a paper titled Weaponized Interdependence, which quickly became one of the most widely cited papers about economic coercion. The paper spurred scholars and policymakers to recognize how the networks that underpin a globalized world can be exploited by powerful states to compel policy change or deter unwanted action. Henry Farrell is professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced and International Studies, where he is the Agora Institute Professor for International Affairs. Abraham Newman is professor at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, where he is the director of the Mortara Center for International Studies. Together, Henry and Abe are the authors of two recent books, Of Privacy and Power, The Transatlantic Fight Over Freedom and Security, which was published in 2019, and Underground Empire, How America Weaponized the World Economy, which was published last year. Henry, thanks for coming on to the show.
Delighted to be here.
Abe, great to have you.
Great to be here.
So I want to start by asking a question that I've been meaning to ask you both for years. You have a reputation as kind of a dynamic duo when it comes to people studying sanctions. And studying economic coercion, sanctions, export controls, other kinds of measures is inherently interdisciplinary. And I imagine that you both bring different expertise and strengths to the table. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about your intellectual partnership and how you work together. Henry, if you'd like to start.
Sure. Well, we have been working together for decades. We began to get to know each other back when we were, I was a postdoc in Germany, and Abe was finishing up his dissertation research. And at that point, we were both talking about the same kinds of topics. We were interested in the same kinds of questions. And we also were desperate to get academic jobs. And that can create a lot of tensions, a lot of worries. But luckily for both of us, we both liked each other very, very much. And we started figuring out ways in which we could work together and talk together. And over time, we have just been really thinking through how the global economy works. First of all, we began to think about primarily Europe and US relations. This was where we began. We both are scholars of comparative politics, i.e. what happens within countries, who drifted into international relations, that is politics of what happens between countries. And then we began to move from privacy to start thinking about this broader set of infrastructural questions. And really what happened is when we were writing the book about privacy, which you mentioned, we talked about this rather obscure-seeming organization called SWIFT. And after we had finished writing, Abe had the idea. He more or less said, there's something important about SWIFT that people aren't paying attention to in international affairs. It seems like a really boring organization, but in fact, it has a lot of politics. Let's try to do something about this. And Abe knew that I was interested more generally in networks, how networks worked. I have another collaboration with a colleague who is a statistical physicist, who's really interested in the mathematics of this. So he thought rightly that we could maybe put these things together into an intellectual package. And so we wrote this piece. And I think we had both been writing this book together, which had been just like drawing teeth. It had taken literally more than a decade to write. It had been a very, very complicated, messy, difficult book to write, where we had multiple meetings like, oh my God, we don't know where this is going. Do we have an argument? Is anybody going to pay attention? Is anybody going to be interested? And so it was a very, very painful book to write. But the article that became Weaponized Interdependence, it really almost seemed like it was writing itself. I've never had that experience before. I don't know if Abe has had this, where you begin with an idea, and the idea that you start with is the idea that you end up with as well, where effectively you don't find yourself running into some unexpected roadblock in the middle. And it took us a couple of months to write in more or less the version that ended up being published. We had a much longer section on financial sanctions, which we had to take out because we just didn't have enough room to stuff it into the article. And it just turned out to be, I guess, for us the right article at the right time. And we've been going ever since.
So I'd like to get into the impact that this weaponized interdependence article had. But before I get there, Abe, I want to hear a little bit about what it's like working with Henry. I mean, during the sound check, Henry recited a Robert Frost poem, which maybe says something a bit about the kinds of people that are working together on this book. So, Abe, what are your reflections?
Well, I would just say we had this very momentous beer in Bonn, Germany, you know, about 20 years ago, where it could have gone either way. You know, you could have ended up going to fisticuffs, as you might say. But Henry is just a sweet guy, and I'm a general optimist. And so we made, you know, I think the magic happened in the decision not to confront each other, but to like join forces. And it's been an amazing journey since then. I do want to just emphasize something that Henry said, which is that Henry and I came to these questions really from other debates. And I would just underscore first, we were both interested in digital politics. And at the time, very few people were studying that in international relations. You know, you could count on your hand. And so, you know, our entry point were things like SWIFT or surveillance questions. You know, they weren't the traditional sanctions questions, even though they became so important, especially after 9/11. And then the other thing that Henry mentioned was network analysis, social network analysis. So I had this random professor in graduate school, Chris Ansell, and he had written this paper that was very influential in that space with a guy named Paget. It was about the Medici family. But he taught a course on social network analysis, and I had taken that in graduate school. And Henry had had this other experience with computational physics, and it was just kind of one of those things where a lot of scholars, those weren't things that we learned for this collaboration, but were just lurking in our backgrounds, which then gave us a common language that, you know, it made it so easy to say, oh, we have this other perspective and we have, you know, these other tools to speak to it. And I think that it just, it emphasizes in this moment today how, the traditional toolbox of economics and political science really needs to be broadened if we're going to understand how to manage this world that we find ourselves in.
So I think the point about common language is so important. I remember reading the working paper when it first came out before the paper was formally published. And my reaction was that this was like a kind of divine revelation, that finally there was this language to explain what was happening around us. And it's really striking that you're pointing out that language about understanding the significance of networks, there's a kind of disciplinary approach to it from the sciences, which is about sort of physical networks, things rooted in these sort of rules. And then there is a disciplinary approach that comes from the study of networks of people, social networks, and how people relate to one another in a political way. You sort of aim in the Weaponized Interdependence paper to develop a different understanding of state power. Can you walk us through a little bit about what is that argument that you were advancing, and really why was it something that you felt was necessary to the contribution? Maybe, Abe, you can take the first stab at that.
Sure. And here, I think Henry and I would both say there's a political scientist who was at GW, Charlie Glaser, and he really, this was, I think of all the feedback we got, it really drove this point of the paper, where he was like, you have to focus on state power, and that should be, you know, the outcome is economic coercion. And for us, what we wanted to argue was that the structure of globalization is not fixed. And it can take on many dimensions. You know, so a lot of people are like, well, there's globalization and or there isn't. But it's actually that the underlying things like how telecommunications networks work or financial networks or production networks, that there's a structure and that structure creates these opportunities for states to do different things. And in the paper, we identify these two, you know, ways. The one is surveillance. So we call it the panopticon effect, where they can use these central points in the networks to observe their enemies. Or the second is the choke point effect, where they're able to exclude actors from that. And both of these come from this structural dimension of economic networks, which, you know, you can contrast to like traditional IR scholars, which are just thinking, you know, let's count up the tanks or let's just see how big is their economy. But this other perspective is grounding state power in how states sit in the economy that companies have largely created.
You know, it strikes me that you described yourselves as a sweet guy and an optimist, and here you are writing about the panopticon and choke points. And it, like, I'm not sure that Michel Foucault was maybe a sweet guy or an optimist in quite the same way. So it's interesting that you're looking at these really hard-nosed issues. But it also seems important that you weren't kind of sequestered in a, you know, small liberal arts college in the woods when you were writing this. At the time, you were both teaching at Georgetown. You were sitting in Washington. Henry, tell us a little bit about what was in the air in Washington at the time that made it so easy in a way to write the weaponized interdependence paper, where it was just sort of coming together.
So in a sense, the conversation that we first came in on, as I suggested, is that we were both people who were interested primarily in the European Union and the United States and the relationship between the two. And if you read the original weaponized interdependence article, it really is more than anything else. It is an article about what happened in EU-US relations after the collapse of the JCPOA. So that really is the major theme. That is the driving force. Of course, it isn't all of the story that we tell, but that really is where the article begins from, is the sense in the after the collapse of the JCPOA, when we begin to see the Trump administration really talking about sanctioning its allies in ways which we hadn't seen that discussion happening for decades. And we had never seen it go nearly as far as it did. We began to see, I think, the power of the United States being revealed in ways that were much, much more visceral, much more obvious than they had been in the past. And one of the themes of weaponized interdependence and of the book that we later wrote is that all of this has been happening for decades. People had not been paying much attention to it. This had been the topic of grumpy letters back and forth between ambassadors rather than the front page of the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, and wherever. And so then when our article came out, it actually came out at a slightly later stage when the conversation had moved on to debates about the US relationship with China. And there, I think people did have that sense that you suggested, which is the way I would put it is that the article has a tune that you can hum, which a lot of academic articles do not. If you read it, you probably want to have a very limited understanding of what the existing debates among international relations scholars are to get a sense of where this article comes from and where it is going. But that is all you need. You do not need to be somebody who is in the thick of the academic fights or in the thick of the kinds of jargon that academics use. We tried very deliberately to be as non-jargonistic as we possibly could. And so when you begin to articulate, to make visible the ways in which networks intersect with global power, you do begin to give people a framework that they can use to understand a much broader set of phenomena, indeed than the phenomena that we actually described in the paper. And so then we saw people, including people in the Trump administration, really latch onto this notion of weaponized interdependence as explaining this new domain of power that was emerging and as giving them a way in which they could perhaps articulate to themselves things which I think everybody had had half of a sense in the back of their heads that something like this was happening. And suddenly they have a language that they can use to describe it. And I think, when you describe that sense, there are two different kinds of discovery articles, I think, that you can write. One is the really profound version, the one in which you announce to the world something that people have never actually been able to think before, and you come down from the mountaintop bearing the tablets. Another, and this is, I think, the kind of article that we wrote, is where you are able to explain in a clear and visible way stuff that has been on the tip of people's tongues, and they haven't been able to talk about it in the explicit ways that they wanted to. And suddenly you provide people with that vocabulary. So we found ourselves providing the vocabulary. As I say, we began with this debate over the United States and Europe and the response to the breakdown of the JCPOA with Iran. But then as the confrontation with China began to wind up, as we began to see also the stuff happening in Russia, we saw people building upon our ideas and using our ideas to explain those phenomena as well, because they did seem to fit to some degree with the kinds of ideas that we were articulating.
And Abe, Henry's basically describing this paradigm that you presented, and then following that, there was a kind of paradigm shift in how people discussed weaponized interdependence. Dan Dresner, another scholar who works on sanctions, you know, wrote about why weaponized interdependence was a new idea, but noted that interdependence itself is something that people have been writing about for a long time, usually to sort of point out that it was a good thing, that interdependence allowed, you know, states to find mutual benefit, and then it could be stabilizing for the relations between states. Why do you think it took so long for this other aspect of interdependence to come to light and for you to articulate how interdependence could be something that was the structure or basis for coercion?
Sure. I mean, I think that there's probably at least two elements. On the one hand, the structures that this network-based asymmetric interdependence in which, you know, certain countries have control over these hubs that can exert a lot of power, that, you know, it takes a while for that to develop. It's very difficult to remember, but, you know, through the 1970s, there were capital controls in many financial systems. There weren't global banks. You know, it's like you had to have the Big Bang in London, and then, you know, the EU, they basically liberalized their markets in the late 90s, 2000s. You know, this idea that Deutsche Bank could be an arm of the US government's, you know, effort to get at Iran, you know, that has to develop through the growth of these financial networks, which take time. It's similarly, you know, the internet. These weren't global systems, you know, in the same way that they are today, where you have just these few firms with so much control, and also production systems. You know, production systems were mostly national through the 1980s and even the 1990s. And so a company like TSMC is a relatively recent creation. So on the one hand, I think it is, you know, we're arguing that the structure, the way markets work changes, and that creates this power. But the other, you know, in the book and also in the article, it's really the transformative effect that 9/11 has on the way the U.S. state is thinking about globalization. You know, it's like up until that point, at least in our story, globalization had really been seen as that old model of, you know, it was going to provide wealth and peace and generate opportunity. And, you know, the U.S. experienced something that they could have never, or they did not expect or predict, which was that these networks would be used as a means of violence. And I think when we talk about 9/11, we always try to remind people, I think it's been underestimated how it has transformed the U.S. state and the way it functions and the way it's transformed international relations, in particular in this idea that globalization is also a vulnerability, not just an opportunity, and that it can be used as a weapon both against U.S. interests, but then increasingly the U.S. then thought about how could it use these networks to its own advantage. And there, much more in the book than in the article, we really try to talk about the kind of the fumbling through, you know, how the U.S. government is stumbling over these different maps and different networks and trying to figure out what can it do. And through that, it creates this new set of weapons that I don't think anybody really could have anticipated before both the economic change and then this political moment.
Abe, the point you raise about 9/11, I think, is really key. And in fact, for another episode of this podcast, I spoke to Saleha Mohsin, who has just published a book called Paper Soldiers. And in the book, she makes a very compelling argument that basically the weaponization of the financial system began 2 weeks after the September 11th attacks, when the U.S. decided, even before it announced airstrikes or any real military action, to use financial measures to try and respond to basically al-Qaeda's attack on the U.S. And I think that kind of points us to this idea that you raised, that these things had to develop over time. And going back to, I think, Henry's example of SWIFT, it strikes me as important that at some point in the last sort of 20 years, you started to have this awareness among U.S. policymakers that they could use the global payments messaging system, SWIFT, as a site of control. And in the book, rather in the paper of Weaponized Interdependence, you talk about systemic inequalities, that some states have an ability to leverage these networks, but not others. Can you tell us a little bit more about why those inequalities arise, and what does it mean for kind of the small number of states that can take advantage of these networks?
Sure. I mean, I think Henry and I, our basic argument there is just that during this period where these networks develop, you know, starting in the 1970s through the 2000s, in many cases, the United States is at its peak of economic predominance. And so a lot of these networks are based around U.S. firms. And in the book, we tell the story of Citibank. There's this protagonist, Walter Wriston, who, you know, he thinks he's going to be the piratical hero who's going to go beyond the state and create these global firms that are going to create opportunities, you know, where governments can't get in their way. And they end up creating these networks that, you know, reposition the state, you know, in this key role, because ultimately Citi has its, you know, financial and economic headquarters in the United States. That being said, I spent a year in Berlin last year, and you always hear, you know, European officials kind of bemoaning the fact of, oh, we don't have any of these opportunities, and, you know, oh, woe is me. But ultimately, in the paper, in the original weaponized interdependence paper, you know, the initial actions that are taken to use SWIFT as a coercive tool against Iran, you know, those, it's actually European law that does that. You know, the U.S. is pushing Europe to do it, and they do it together in a joint effort. But it is European legal efforts to do that. And if you think about the Russia sanctions today and the ECB's kind of freezing of Russian central bank reserves, there's no doubt that other actors in the system have these capabilities. That being said, you know, when you look at emerging powers like China or Brazil or India, you know, their private actor networks are just less developed than the U.S. or Europe, and so it's fewer places where they can engage in this type of power. That doesn't mean that they don't have other forms of economic coercion that they can use, but it's usually just based off of more traditional market access, which has different strengths and weaknesses compared to this network form of power that we describe.
One of the things that I think has changed since you wrote the paper in 2019 is that the definition of what the Europeans were bemoaning has changed. So you had a moment in 2019 when European officials were talking about their economic sovereignty and were really concerned about not being able to do business with, in this case, Iran, because of U.S. secondary sanctions, so this special privilege of the U.S. to basically compel banks to stop transactions from going through, even for trade that's permitted between, let's say, a European and Iranian entity. And as you just mentioned, with the sort of Russia sanctions program now in place, what we hear from European officials about economic sovereignty is that they want to demonstrate their economic sovereignty by making it clear that their sanctions have bite even before the U.S. sanctions come into play. And you have this kind of coordination, transatlantic coordination on sanctions, but really the Europeans want to show that they have an independent effort. And this evolution, I think, is also something that must come through in sort of the scholarship that you've done since that original paper. You did publish two subsequent books. There was Of Privacy and Power and Underground Empire, which came out last year. Henry, what sort of spurred you to then go from the paper into these two book projects? And, you know, should we think of the paper and the two books as a kind of trilogy? I mean, is this the end of the project? Do you feel that you've sort of said what you needed to say on this? Or is there more to be done?
That's a very good question. So you can think about the paper. Okay. You can think about the paper, if you want to do trilogy, as being Dune. That is, you have this paper, which is really, it's about, you don't really want to be in a world where this stuff is happening. This is not necessarily a good thing. Weaponized interdependence is not awesome. But then, as happens with Frank Herbert's original Dune, you have all these people sort of rushing out and thinking, oh my God, Paul Atreides, he is so awesome. Okay, maybe he launches a massive galactic catastrophe in which billions and billions of people die. But isn't he so soulful? Look at gazing at the camera, etc., etc., etc. So then you have sort of Dune Messiah, which is Herbert's book, where he really goes into the lousiness of power, how it is that behind all of this sort of glorious awesome, you find yourself in a much, much messier situation. And here, I think that the second and the third volumes effectively are our doom messiah. And in some ways, they are also pushing back against some of the ways in which some of our ideas have been used by policymakers. Because one of the most terrifying moments for Abe and I was, if you look at the bookshelf behind me, you will see, if I move my arm just over here, you will see Chip War by Chris Miller. And so I got my copy of Chip War the day it came out. Abe and I were finishing writing the book, and we were, we were a little bit nervous because Chris has been doing work on semiconductors, and Chip War is about semiconductors for a long, long time. He had been thinking about this much more deeply. Semiconductors is just one issue that we're concerned with. So I got the book and I started reading it immediately, thinking, oh my God, is there some place where we're going to discover that we have it wrong and that Chris has it right? Happily, we did not discover that. But what we did discover towards the end of the book is we discovered our names being mentioned. And we had this moment where Miller talks about how it is that Henry Farrell and Abraham Newman had this idea of weaponized interdependence. And then he describes a senior Trump official who he does not name as deciding that this idea of weaponized interdependence is awesome. Let's use it on semiconductors and let's use it to develop rules which prevent Chinese companies such as Huawei from having access to advanced semiconductors. And so in a certain weird sense, we found ourselves being woven into the story that we wanted to tell. So you can think about the second book happens before we know any of this. This is a book that Dan Dresner suggests that we run a conference around weaponized interdependence, get a bunch of people together who have interesting thoughts, some of them agreeing, some of them disagreeing, in order to figure out what is the academic debate that we ought to have going forward. And then at that at that meeting, we talk to Dan and we talk to Mark Blyse about what should we do next. And they both yell at us, write a book. You've got to write a book. You've got to write a broad interest book that helps to explain to people what is happening. And so we do that. But as we're writing that book, as I say, we really begin to understand how some of these ideas have been used in ways that are somewhat, problematic. They certainly aren't the ideas that we thought that we were offering to the world. It's kind of like, may you wish for policy influence as an academic, and you make that wish and a finger of the monkey's paw curls. And so we are, in a sense, saying, if you want to live in a world in which this is true, in which people believe these things, in which these vulnerabilities are there, you do not want to figure out how can we turn the volume up to 11. You want to try and figure out ways of coexisting in a world and dialing down some of the tensions. And really, that is what the book is about. As Abe said, a lot of the book explains how the system of economic coercion that surrounds weaponized interdependence really came into being in a very, very haphazard way. People were not paying attention to the broader consequences of what they were doing. They were desperately trying to solve short-term crises and not thinking about what kinds of long-term consequences their actions might have. And so really what we're doing is we're trying to push for a re-evaluation of this, that if we want to have a moment of understanding the force of what has been unleashed, this should not be a Paul Atreides is awesome and isn't he cute moment. This should be a how do we actually think about the strategic situation that we have found ourselves in, and how do we make sure that that doesn't get worse and ideally gets a little better than it is at the moment.
To Abe, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I love Dune, so I'm not gonna argue with that. I just want to give a different image of how these things might fit together as well, which is in a lot of ways the original article was a static view of how power worked given a specific constellation of the networks. So, this is how the networks look, and this is what the US or an actor could do in that situation. And in the book, as Henry said, it's one of its main objectives is a warning, and how do we de-escalate this stuff from getting really bad. But the other point is to show the dynamic interaction that actors aren't just going to sit there and say, oh, okay, so you're using the global economy against me, so I guess that's fine. But they respond. And so kind of what are those sets of responses, and how can you think about a more dynamic model of how weaponized interdependence plays out? And I think that a lot of the work that we're doing right now is thinking about those questions. You know, what does China do in response? How do we think about how private actors are engaged and, you know, what is their role in this interaction? And where are maybe the risks of overusing these powers and how could they really undermine U.S. interests?
And Abe, I guess building on that, I mean, it sounds like given the apprehension you had that, you know, a U.S. official would be happy that weaponized interdependence had emerged as something that they could point to and say, this is a way that the U.S. should be exercising power. It sort of sounds like implicit in a lot of what you're writing was a criticism of how the U.S. had begun to exercise power over these networks, taking advantage of systemic inequalities that you talk about, both in the paper and in the books. I mean, how important is that to you that, you know, what you're doing here in a way is holding up a mirror for policymakers in Washington to look at their policies and maybe consider that they're having a deleterious effect on the globalization that a lot of people had hoped would be broadly good and maybe also constraining for superpowers in terms of how they could take advantage of other states?
Definitely. I mean, I think that ultimately, the tools that we talk about, these economic weapons, they're not a strategy. They're not an objective. They're just a tactic. You know, they're a tool that states use. And our concern is that these tools are being used in a very incremental kind of crisis response mode. And so the story that we tell in the underground empire is really, you know, overworked bureaucrats face crisis after crisis, whether it's 9/11, North Korea, the Iranian negotiation, now Russia. And in each case, they're trying to figure out how can they manage the situation. And these tools are there and they use them. And it's not some kind of a grand plan of how they can, you know, turn economic tools against people in an evil, whoever the villain is of the Dune saga at the moment. But instead, it's much more, a very incremental way where we worry that there's not a grand strategy. And so as a result, you're going to have a lot of miscommunication, the potential for tit and tat escalation, undermining trust in the global economy as a cooperative endeavor. And so ultimately, we're not saying you can't use these things. They're very powerful. They can have completely legitimate and important ends. And I think, for example, the Russia sanctions campaign is one of those examples where this is totally legitimate and important to have these tools in our disposal as the U.S. government to use. But all that being said, those uses have to be wrapped in a strategy that signals to people that, you know, globalization is not a battlefield per se, but it's just these particular areas where these tools will be used. And so I think that's kind of been our big push in particular with the book.
So the other thing I would say, just building on what Abe says, is that one of the worries we have is that the United States is in a confrontation with China. China is not a particularly nice or friendly country across a wide variety of different dimensions. If you look at the ways in which the Uyghur minority is treated, if you look at human rights, there are a variety of different problems that China has, which are pretty profound problems. But equally, when you look at the way in which the United States thinks of China, it tends to think of it in a very non-strategic way. And it tends to think of it as a adversary which is so powerful, which is so profound, that it perhaps justifies the United States doing things which are themselves somewhat problematic and somewhat oppressive. So if we want to return to the Dune simile, here this is the Atreides thinking, actually, we are kind of Harkonnens after all. Let's just go with that. And we're not as evil as the Harkonnens. You know, so nobody could possibly be as hairless and as repellent as the Harkonnens are when they are doing their full thing. We are the noble of Paul and Jessica, etc., etc. We are just doing these bad things, but nobody's going to be as worried about this because we are genuinely good people. And I think really the message is that if you do bad things, you sometimes have to do bad things because you're trapped in a perfect world. But if this becomes second nature to you, you end up being exactly that which you are looking to push back against. And you also weaken yourself, because I think one of the big problems that the United States has is that the more that it comes close to being China in terms of behaving in ways that are really not hampered by the rule of law, where it sees itself as behaving opportunistically in response to this or that kind of threat, the more that that happens, the weaker is the United States' ability to influence other countries to buy into its system in a world in which suddenly there are other options than the US-led so-called rules-based international order. There are far more options than there used to be. And there really is not yet that kind of, at least explicit out in the public, strategic discussion of what the United States ought to do. And I think that there are big worries. There are enormous worries and immediate worries if Trump gets back in November. There are broader, longer-term worries if Trump does not, about what might happen as the baton keeps on getting handed from Democratic to Republican administrations, and as the temptation to use these tools increases, and perhaps increases to some degree, even as economic power dwindles on the basis that you want to use these things while they are still useful weapons in the world rather than after the thing has decayed.
So I want to get to that sort of moment that we're now in, where there is flux in the global system and it might have a bearing on what happens next for weaponized interdependence. But to round out our conversation about Dune, I mean, I would say that maybe there's something in here for the two of you to write a sort of appraisal of where weaponized interdependence exists in the Dune universe. After all,
it's all about spice.
It's all about spice. Dune itself is a choke point. So, you know, it seems like there's something there. But the point that you raised as well about policymakers having to respond to this endless wave of crises on another episode of this show spoke to Delaney Simon, whose work is a lot on the effects of sanctions on peace building. And she did a lot of work around understanding the Biden administration's use of sanctions. And, you know, we agreed in that conversation that just as we should have some sympathy for Paul in his predicament, we should have sympathy for U.S. policymakers that are facing, you know, really difficult choices about what the optimal response is to a whole host of crises. But the global landscape is changing. And in 2020, you wrote an essay in Foreign Affairs where you indicated that maybe the pandemic was going to be that, you know, sort of tipping point for globalization and some of these networks as we understood them. It's kind of amazing to think that your paper was from 2019. It feels like just yesterday, but the pandemic has that effect on warping our sense of time. And we are in a different situation now. One thing that comes to mind is that the pandemic did break some taboos around things like industrial policy. It seemed to highlight for policymakers that having very attenuated, complicated supply chains is maybe not great from a national security perspective. And now we have in the US, for example, a real effort with the CHIPS Act and the Inflation Reduction Act to try and bring more production domestically. So I'm curious to know, Abe, you know, what is the outlook for weaponized interdependence in a world where there is this push to try and de-risk from the global economy?
Well, I think, you know, one of the main takeaways from that paper that we did in 2020 was just to identify the fact that many global supply chains had been pushed to extreme limits in terms of just-in-time production and lean production in a way that they weren't very resilient when it came to crisis. And that, of course, in the pandemic was showing how that can play out when there's a random shock to these supply chains, when, you know, you can't predict it, it just happens. It's like there have been similar studies about tsunamis in the Japanese car, you know, production network. But how it interfaces with our work is in the fact that it might not be random how those shocks are introduced into these supply chains, but it could be actually a state doing it intentionally. And so I think that between COVID, the Russia crisis, China and US tech conflicts, we're increasingly seeing that this isn't just about sanctions. It's not just about information, but it's also about these production systems and how they're configured, and that states are increasingly testing around how they could or couldn't manipulate them. And the export control system that the US is increasingly using against China, I think, is a great example of how that is being implemented. in terms of the question of, you know, how will these tools function in our world going forward, I think it does depend on how we think about what globalization is going to look like in 5, 10, and, you know, 50 years. I think one of the points that Henry and I try to argue, you know, in terms of advocacy, is that it's to our benefit to maintain globalization as much as possible in you know, the biggest scope as possible. And so really trying to think about, well, what are the more green light areas? What are the areas where there's very low risk and we should maintain economic engagement? What are the areas that are really more concerning and that where there might need to be some strategic de-risking or decoupling? And then where are the gray areas? And we had a piece in Foreign Affairs in December where one of the things, you know, we highlight is the European Union is engaging in this kind of risk assessment tool to identify those things, but also think about the risks of the response. You know, like if you use export controls, if you use sanctions, what are the likely problems that might happen when you use them? And unfortunately, I think many countries, including the United States, they don't have that yet in their disposal. And so pretty concerning.
So just to build on that, what this gets back in some ways to what you asked at the beginning about the relationship between network theory and our arguments, because if you look at this distinction that Abe is pulling out here, this is a distinction that really comes from basic network theory. So if you look at the kinds of networks that pull together substantial portions of the global economy, they're not exactly scale-free networks. This is a particular concept in physics about where you get on sort of these networks in which some nodes are more vastly more important than other nodes, and this falls along a statistical distribution called a power law. But for all intents and purposes, they're pretty similar. And so such networks, they have two properties. First of all, they tend to be pretty robust against random shocks. That is, if you delete a particular random node from the network, instead of doing it purely at random, that probably isn't going to hurt the networks working all that much. But then, according to Barabasi and others who have studied this, if you then instead you target specific nodes, you target the most important nodes in the network, then you can have rapid and very, very substantial consequences, which may lead to the complete degeneration of the network as a whole if you delete a few high-value nodes. And so this then, I think, provides a different understanding of what the vulnerabilities of the global economy are. And one thing that I would also add to that is, you know, we don't have very good ways of thinking about what the consequences of this are. We don't have this in schools that Abe and I teach in. We certainly don't have it in policymaking. And one thing that I've been wondering about recently is geopolitical stress testing. That is, we should be thinking just in the same way as after the banks and the financial crisis, you began to see the stress testing of banks in order to figure out how would they deal with this or that scenario. We need to have geopolitical stress testing of the various, not simply banks, but also the decision-making structures and institutions that we have in order to see how are they robust under this or that set of plausible assumptions, this or that scenario. Because if we don't have that kind of stress testing happening on a level of modeling and thinking things true, we are certainly going to have actual geopolitics stress testing our systems to hell, and we're going to discover all sorts of vulnerabilities and failure points that we are not aware of right now, and that is a rather, rather frightening scenario.
So this takes me, I think, to the next question I wanted to ask, which is really what comes next in terms of your research. We've talked about it a little bit with regards to, for example, this idea of the stress testing. You know, it does seem like you both introduced a new paradigm through which to understand interdependence, and the world is catching up, maybe reacting a little bit to you having pulled back the curtain, and suddenly networks of globalization that looked like they were distributing opportunity now look like they're distributing risk, and that may require other forms of accounting in terms of trying to understand where that risk comes from. So Abe, I mean, when you think about what's at the top of your list for further research on economic coercion, you know, briefly, what comes to mind?
Sure. So I'm thinking about three different buckets that are really interesting to me. One is what people in the sanctions area often call re-risking. So, you know, it's you obtain your objective, people decouple from Iran, let's say, from their banks. but that that has consequences for other actors that are politically or economically connected to Iran as well. And so I have a paper that came out recently that looked at bank lending, not just to Iran post the sanctions, but to geographically connected or politically connected countries. And what you see is that they lose access to banking corridors as well. And that what then happens is that offshore financial centers, they move in. So you get these more risky actors who are providing those loans. And so while it might be partially the objective of the US government to limit that economic activity, it's unlikely that they really want kind of sketchy banks to be the primary providers. And so how do you get policy that both achieves its objective but prevents these kinds of unanticipated spillovers? The second bucket is kind of how states are reacting. I think we have a very overly optimistic view of how countries respond to weaponized interdependence. That's kind of like, well, they'll just create their own networks and they'll be happy and, you know, they'll fight back. But I think increasingly you see, whether it's China or other countries, it's not that simple. And there's a lot of internal politics involved that gets in the way. And then the final bucket is, I think Henry and I are both really committed to trying to think about policy interventions that could de-escalate these kinds of conflicts. And so we have this piece in Foreign Affairs in the fall, in December. And I think we're thinking right now kind of a similar set of conversations that are really focused on firms. You know, if you're TSMC or Microsoft or Apple, how do you manage this system? Because it's not just states that need to manage these kinds of tumult, but also companies who are often the foot soldiers on the battlefield implementing these forms of restrictions.
So Henry, Abe, we've reached the end of our time, which means I need to ask you the question that we ask each of our guests. And that is the question, when did you realize that sanctions were changing the world? Henry, if you want to go first.
I guess I realized it just by paying attention to how financial sanctions work and realizing decades ago they didn't actually work in the way that international relations scholars thought that they worked, that there really wasn't very much attention being paid, for example, to secondary sanctions in the literature, because they didn't work in the ways that scholars, you know, that fit into scholars' theories. So I've had the sense for a long, long time that sanctions are really important. But I think it was just when Abe and I began to come together, and we began to realize the connections between financial coercion and SWIFT and the dollar clearing system. That is when we really began to be able to put voice, you know, in a certain sense. What you could say is, as I said earlier, we described how it is that the world worked in ways that made sense to a lot of people, and that put in those people's mouths the language that they needed to use this. But we also needed to develop that language for ourselves, because before we had that language, this just appeared to be a set of important concerns, but ones that we didn't really have a very, very good way of talking about.
And Abe, when did you realize?
I mean, for me, it was really a series of these of exposés or whistleblowers who kind of opened up our understanding of what was happening in the post 9/11 world. And so there was this piece which revealed what was happening in the SWIFT situation. It was a New York Times story, Licht, and I can't remember, Henry, you'll have to tell me the other guy's name. It's not important right now, but they had a really important
Licht, Blau, and Resin. Eric Licht, Blau, and
Licht, Blau, and Resin. Yeah. That piece, I think, was really eye-opening. And then, of course, I think for me, one of the biggest things was the Snowden revelations. It's not something that people often think about in terms of sanctions. You know, it's not a sanctions revelation, but it's a revelation about economic coercion and how the global economy, the structure of it, is being used for power. And I still come back to those documents and find them, they're so important. And I feel like many people have not internalized what they show for the world about how markets and power are really integrally linked with each other.
Abe, thank you so much for taking the time to join the conversation.
Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
And Henry, likewise, it was a pleasure to have you on the show.
Likewise, it was a lot of fun to talk about these things and to have a more in-depth conversation than I think we usually are able to have.
Happy to hear it. I'm Esfandyar Batmagelidj, and this has been The Sanctions Age. Our show is produced by Spiritland Productions and is supported by a grant from the Halling Center for International Dialogue. Thanks for listening.